Westminster Confession of Faith, which deals with the fall of man and the sin of man and the punishment of God upon it. And first of all, I want to read from section 1 and 2 of chapter 6. Our first parents, being seduced by the subtlety and temptation of Satan, sinned in eating the forbidden fruit. This, their sin, God was pleased, according to his wise and holy counsel, to permit, having purposed to order it to his own glory. By this sin, they fell from their original righteousness and communion with God, and so became dead in sin and wholly defiled in all the faculties and parts of soul and body. Now, the first thing that I'd like to emphasize in dealing with this part of the confession is the tremendous crisis in the authority of the Bible that is today really quite alarming in a lot of the Christian world. When we were in New Zealand, because a lot of our people came from what is called the Reformed churches in the Netherlands, we had a lot of interest in what went on in that home church of many of our people. And in the past 20-25 years, there has been a most astounding change in the outlook of this church with regard to the historicity of Genesis. About the time I was born, I think a year after I was born, in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands, there was a theologian who cast doubt upon the literal and concrete existence in the Garden of Eden of a tree and a serpent that spoke and so on. This theologian didn't want to be bound to the idea that there was a real tree there of the kind that you could bump your head against if you were actually in the garden. He didn't want to be bound to that. And so he was disciplined back in that period. But within recent years, the whole thing has swung the other way, and now this is not maintained as essential. And if any of you are keeping track of what's going on in the Christian Reformed Church, you'll know that not so long ago, a man who graduated from Calvin brought to the attention of the Board of Trustees the fact that one of the professors there, in his opinion, did not hold either to the literal, historical, concrete character of this history. And while that is still in process, at least I have not yet seen any very reassuring statement from this member of the faculty of Calvin. It would be very easy for him to say, "I believe that Adam actually existed as other men exist at a particular time and place, and that there really was such a garden, that there was a tree in it, and so on." He hasn't done that as far as I know yet, and so the matter still remains very much a troubled point. Now, why is it like that today? It is, I believe, because of the tremendous influence of neo-orthodoxy in the Protestant world. Neo-orthodoxy is the name that has been given to a kind of theology which is like the old liberalism in that it doesn't actually take the Bible to be infallible. It is not like the old liberalism in that it likes to use biblical terms and use biblical motifs. But in a way, that makes it even more dangerous. Dr. Van Til at Westminster wrote the famous book, The New Modernism, because of this. Because if you talk about Adam, and if you talk about the fall of man, but you don't really mean a historical person named Adam, and if you don't really mean that at some date on the calendar of time, the human race actually fell, so that before that time it was unfallen, after that time it was fallen, you really do not do justice to biblical teaching. It is certainly clear that the great confessions of the church, including our Westminster Confession, take the Bible to be quite literally true in what they say. Our first parents refers, of course, to the fact that there are other parents, but these were the first historically. And that's a very good way of putting a thing in a creed to obviate this idea of evaporating Adam and Eve into the region of symbol. Adam and Eve are not symbols, they are historical persons who were at the beginning of history. Well, I emphasize this because I believe it is just as important, in a sense, theologically, to believe in the historical Adam as it is to believe in the historical Christ. By that I mean, theologically, it has been proved again and again that if you cease to believe in the historical Adam, you will eventually end up ceasing to believe in the historical Christ. And indeed, it's logical that you would, because if there was no historical Adam, then the biblical explanation of where we are is not valid, and then neither is the biblical solution to that problem anymore as emergent as it was. So I simply emphasize this. I don't want to go into it at length, but I will give you a couple of references. If you look in 1 Timothy, you will see how the inspired Apostle Paul treats the history of the Bible. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11. This also, by the way, is a matter very much in ferment in some Reformed denominations today. In the same Christian Reformed Church, there is enormous pressure building up for women in office. I guess you're all aware of that. Not only as deacons, but as elders and ministers. There's even an organization within the Christian Reformed Church for women seeking this. But now notice what Paul says in 2:11. Let a woman quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For, or because, it was Adam who was first created, then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman, being quite deceived, fell into transgression. Quite clearly, the Apostle Paul takes that Genesis material to be historical, because he has a time distinction between Adam's existence and Eve's. You can't do that if you use them only as symbols. You can't say Adam existed first, then Eve, if you are neo-Orthodox and you treat Adam and Eve only as symbolism, symbolic of generic man or something like that. But you see here in the Bible that this is Paul's view, and not only that, but he argues, therefore, for a continuing effect of that creation fact. If it is a fact creationally that God made man first and then woman, then there is an unchanging basis for the distinction that is made throughout the New Testament as between man and woman when it comes to teaching and authority offices. It's no surprise, then, that in churches where the pressure builds up for women in office, there is also a corresponding pressure to overthrow the creation account. And it is indeed when the one weakens that you see the other. In the Reformed churches of the Netherlands, the first thing I remember was very disturbing ideas about Genesis. Wasn't very many years before they had women in office. And it follows quite logically, the one from the other. But if God did create men and women for two distinct roles, and therefore that has a binding effect right down through the history of the human race, then you have one conclusion, and if not, the other. So the argument that the subordination of women to men in the early church was only culturally determined, a phenomenon of the culture of that particular period, it won't wash if you consider what Paul says, because he doesn't refer to anything cultural. He refers to something creational, and a creational thing is not cultural. It's transcultural. It stands above and beyond all cultures. I take it then that we are all well and truly convinced of the historical and factual truthfulness of the Bible with respect to the beginning of history and of our first parents. And I believe we've also dealt adequately with the fact that the fall of man, as well as all other events, have been included in God's purpose and decree. God did not cause man to sin, but God did plan for the fall of man and indeed the redemption of the world, because the Bible says the Lamb of God was slain from before the foundation of the world. The central purpose of God always was to redeem through Jesus, his Son. And so the fall of man was not a surprise to God. It was not an overthrowing of his plan. It was a part of it, yet not in any way that makes him the author of it. Now, the second part of the confession: by this sin, they fell from their original righteousness and communion with God, and so became dead in sin and wholly defiled in all the faculties and parts of soul and body. Now, the biblical data for that statement is certainly profuse. To begin with, if you go back there to Genesis chapter 2, we read in chapter 2, verse 17, "From the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat of it, for in the day that you eat from it," it reads in your text and mine, "you shall surely die." In the Hebrew, it reads, "dying you shall die." It is commonly said that man did not die that day, but that God stayed the hand of his judgment so that man didn't die for about 900 years. That's not correct. Man died that day and went on dying until death was completed. In other words, death is a process, and the process immediately affected the human race, and it works itself out until the terrible completeness of what the New Testament in the book of Revelation calls the second death. That is when death is complete. It has reached its full reality. But nevertheless, the death overtook our first parents on the day that they sinned. And the way that death overtook them was, as our confession puts it, they became dead in sin. Anyone know where that statement is found in the Bible, that man is dead in sin? Any of you remember? Okay, well, try and remember. These are main texts you should know if you're dealing with people and talking to him about the gospel, chapter 2 of Ephesians. And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them we too all formerly lived. Now, that sounds like a contradiction. We lived in death. We were dead, it says in verse 1, and it says we lived in the lusts of our flesh in verse 3. That's the problem when we're talking about being dead in sin. The man who is dead in sin is the man who's living in sin. And that sounds like a contradiction. In a sense, it is a contradiction. But what is death? That's the question. What is death? Well, according to that passage, it is to be under the power of the prince of the air. It is to have the spirit, meaning the evil spirit of hell, working in us. It means to live according to the course of the world and so on. In other words, it means being totally alienated from God, being His enemy, and that is what we in the Reformed community have come to call the doctrine of man's total depravity. Our confession says, wholly defiled in all the faculties and parts of soul and body. Now please turn to two other passages before I try to discuss this a bit with you. Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. This is before the flood, when the Lord grieved at the wickedness of man and so on, and then destroyed the world with a flood. It says in Genesis 6, verse 5, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. You'll notice there that the wickedness of man was great in God's opinion. It was inward. It was in the thoughts and intents of the hearts that it could be clearly seen. It was unrelieved, only evil, and it was constant, continually. If you analyze that statement very carefully, you will see that it is a very devastating and watertight statement of man's depravity. Look also at Psalm 14. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Literally, in the Hebrew, it says, the fool has said in his heart, God is not. To say there is no God suggests that the man doesn't believe in any kind of God whatsoever, but that's not the force of it. What he is saying is, Elohim is not. See? The God of the Bible doesn't exist. He might think there's some God, but that's what he's really saying. The God of the Bible doesn't exist. Then what does it say? They are corrupt. They have committed abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. The Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none. No one who does good, not even one. So the corruption is great, it is universal, and it is unrelieved. One other passage, Romans 3, Paul's famous indictment, where he says, after lengthy argumentation in verse 9, we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin, as it is written. And then he quotes from a number of Old Testament passages, including the one I just cited, Psalm 14, but also a lot of others. And you notice he kind of gives you the whole anatomy of man. Their throat, verse 13, is an open grave. With their tongues they deceive. Their mouth is full of cursing. Their feet shed blood. In other words, he kind of gives you a universal description of all the parts of man and says, look at that, that's evil too, and that's evil too. Now, it's on the basis of data like this, and in one of the prophets we read, from the sole of the foot to the crown of the head, there's no sounds in it, nothing sound in man, only putrefying sores and so on. That's a kind of way of describing it. All of this adds up to what we have in mind when we speak of man's total depravity. Now, what do we mean when we speak of man's total depravity? I'm going to try to diagrammatically represent this for you on the blackboard, and then if you have any question about the meaning, you can mention. If we let this represent man diagrammatically in the fact that he is rational, his mind, he's a thinking being, he is emotional and aesthetic, he has a heart, he has an emotional nature, and man has a will, he is a choosing being. You might say more, but at least you can see that the nature of man is complex. He has various faculties. And when man was in the Garden of Eden before the fall, his mind was perfectly open to the light of God's truth coming to him through the revelation of nature and, of course, God's Word. And because of man's mind receiving the light of the truth, his heart was also affected by it. And because his heart was affected by it, his will also was directed to respond to God as his servant. Well, now, the fall of man, the rebellion of our first parents, Adam and Eve, changed that radically. Man's mind was no longer open to the truth, and his heart also, and therefore his will in succession. Now, when we speak of the total depravity of man, that's what we're referring to. We are referring to the fact that all of man's nature, all of his faculties, are corrupted by the fall. They are polluted. They become misdirected. Professor Van Til says a university biologist may have a mind as sharp as a saw. The only trouble is, he says, it cuts crooked. And that's the idea, you see. It doesn't mean that man is stupid. He may be diabolically clever, brilliant, but his mind is not operating correctly as God intended it, nor his heart, nor his will. That's what we mean by total depravity. We do not mean that your neighbor, Mr. A, is as bad as he could possibly be. That's not what is meant by the Reformed doctrine of total depravity. It doesn't mean that when your little baby is born, that little baby is as bad as that baby could possibly be. No, it doesn't mean that. But it means that there is no part of the nature of that child born into this world, for we are the children of wrath, even as others, says Paul in Ephesians chapter 2, There is no part of that child's nature, not the mind, not the heart, not the will, that remains undamaged by the fall. Now look at Romans 1 for a moment, and I'll illustrate what I mean by this. Verse 21 of chapter 1, even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations. The same truth is stated again in verse 25. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And again, they did not like to have God in their knowledge. Can't seem to find that, but it's in there someplace. Yes, 28. They did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer. What is clearly stated in those verses is that the mind of man is no longer operating in such a way as to be hospitable to the truth. No, they don't like the truth of God. They won't receive the truth of God. The mind, in other words, is operating in reverse. It is negative toward the truth. That's the mind of man in its fallen condition. They exchange the truth of God for a lie. They don't want to retain God in their knowledge. They become futile in their speculations. Now note what the result of it is. Verse 21. And their foolish heart was darkened. And their foolish heart was darkened. So, as a result of the perversity of the mind, the heart is darkened also. And what happens is that they then degenerate also in their will. What do they do? Verse 28 says, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper. And then it tells us a lot of the things they do, which are, of course, acts of the will. So when we speak about the doctrine of man's total depravity, what we really mean is that the fall of man has had a radical and all-pervasive effect on the nature of man. Now, why is this important? Because historically some, the Arminians notably, have acted as if the will of man escaped undamaged in the fall. That's why they speak of free will, by which they mean that man still has the power to choose either good or evil. They would admit that the mind of man has been deleteriously affected by the fall, maybe the heart too, but the will of man is still free. See, it's a false view of the effects of the fall. Martin Luther, the great reformer, the blockbuster book that he first wrote, which sparked off the Reformation, was The Bondage of the Will, because he came to see that the medieval church was quite in error in talking about the ability of man's will. No, man's will, because of the state of his mind and heart, man's will is in bondage, not freedom. And so that's what we're talking about when we talk about total depravity. And it began in our first parents. Their minds, their hearts, and their wills were no longer as they had been at creation, and their bodies too, but were under the effects of this great sin and fall. Doctrinally, then, we distinguish between the extent of the depravity and the degree. The extent of the depravity is total. The degree of the depravity is not. None of us are finished products. Your neighbor who is totally depraved is not totally depraved yet in extent. Pardon me, in degree. He is in extent. In extent, his mind, his heart, his will extends to all parts of his nature. He is totally depraved. In degree, he is not. He's not as bad as he can be. And there are many reasons why he is not yet as bad as he can be. If you were to diagrammatically represent Satan, he would be not only in mind, heart, and will, if angels have a mind, heart, and will, let's assume they do. He would not only be every part, but he would be completely filled in, as it were, because he is as evil as he can be. And that's not true of your neighbor, Mr. A. He's not as evil as he can be. But in principle, he is like Satan, because every aspect of his nature has been affected by the fall. All right. Now section number 3. They being the root of all mankind, the guilt of this sin was imputed, and the same death in sin and corrupted nature conveyed to all their posterity, descending from them by ordinary generation. And then it says, from this original corruption, whereby we are utterly indisposed, disabled, and made opposite to all good, and wholly inclined to all evil, do proceed all actual transgressions. Now, in our junior catechism tonight, we were talking about this very same truth. The relationship of Adam and Eve, our first parents, to us, their posterity. And I was pointing out to them that in our relationship to Adam and Eve, there are two primary principles. Unity and diversity. There is a sense in which Adam and his descendants are one. There is a sense in which they are many. And the problem that we have with the fall of man and our involvement in the ruin of Adam comes, of course, from this aspect of it. Now, if you believe that God created Adam and Eve historically as the first parents, and if you believe that God created them with the power of reproduction of the species, you've got no problem with this, because then you can see that biologically the human race is one, and we descend from our parents very much like the branches of a tree grow out of the trunk and so on. This is the part of it that gives us the difficulty, because we are also individuals. We are personally responsible before God, and so we have difficulty relating that to the fact that Adam sinned for us in such a way that we sinned in him. And so you have really two principles by which this is explained. One of them is by representation. And the other is by propagation. And you can't explain the truth about our fall without both of those elements. There was a representative principle at work. Adam was appointed by God as our representative. Somewhat analogous to the way that our congressman represents us in Washington, or our elders represent us at Presbytery. There was also then this element in which we are actually biologically one. On the basis of those two principles, propagation and representation, you can then understand how we participated in the sin of Adam. I'm not saying that makes it easy to understand, but it at least does clarify, if you accept divine revelation, how we are the way we are. I also, in speaking to them, talked a little bit about the historic difference that has existed among Christians in explaining our relationship to Adam. And I'll just briefly refer to it. Some have held that God creates the soul immediately, that the body, the physical side of man, comes by ordinary generation or propagation from our parents down through the family tree from Adam, but that God creates the soul. And it's sort of like putting the soul in the body. In other words, the ghost in the machine, as some of the philosophers have called it. I personally don't think that's biblical. I'm quite convinced that the true biblical view is that the whole man, body and soul, is propagated from Adam. In other words, that from my parents I received my whole being, and they from theirs, and so on, right back to Adam and Eve. So that God's creation of the human race was a once-only event, and that he created human beings with the power to propagate not parts of people, but entire people. And I believe that that is less burdened with difficulty in understanding the fall of man. All right, if there are no questions on the doctrine of total depravity, I kind of hope there would be. Do you all have a clear idea of what we mean by total depravity? In explaining to you that total depravity is a matter of extent and not degree, I don't want to make you think it's not serious, because a man who is traveling slowly to hell is in a terrible situation, just as truly as a man who's traveling rapidly. If something doesn't happen, he'll get there. So it's a matter of great importance that we are totally depraved by nature, as we will see as we go on through our study of these doctrines. If there are no questions then, I see that our time is up. We'll have to leave it there, and we'll come back next time to section 5 and 6 for our continued discussion.